Welcome to the Deep Dive. Our mission, as always, is pretty straightforward. We take some foundational material, pull out the absolute core insights, and help you build real intuition around the topic. Today, we're tackling probability, the language of chance. It underpins, well, pretty much everything in data science, inference, you name it. We want to get past just the textbook definitions, you know, figure out what really makes probability a useful tool, the kind of intuition needed for diagnostics, AI, all that stuff.
Exactly. And to do that, we really need to start at the absolute beginning, the setup. Probability always kicks off with an experiment. That's just, you know, some procedure that gives you a result you can measure or observe. And you've got the outcome space, often called the cellars. That's just the complete set of all possible results, everything that could happen. And an event, usually a dollar, is just a specific outcome or maybe a group of outcomes that we happen to be interested in, a subset of dollars.
Right. Like flipping a coin.
Yeah.
The experiment is the flip. Gotcha. The outcome space is just heads, tails. Pretty simple.
Two possible outcomes.
But rolling two dice, that outcome space gets way bigger.
Right.
Suddenly it's 36 possible pairs.
Absolutely. And defining that space precisely is step one. If you want the probability of rolling a 7, your event dollar is that specific set of pairs. 1, 6, 2, 5, 3, 4, and so on. You need clarity on what you're measuring.
Okay. And once this stage is set, we have the rules, the axioms. Non-negotiable, you said.
That's right. They're fundamental. Think of them as three core ideas. First, any probability has to sit somewhere between 0, meaning impossible, and 1, meaning absolutely certain. Can't be negative, can't be 1.5.
Makes sense.
Second, the probability of the entire outcome space, $7, has to be 1. I mean, something has to happen when you run the experiment, right?
Yeah, one of the possible outcomes must occur.
And the third one is really key for calculations, additivity. If you have events that can't happen at the same time they're mutually exclusive, like rolling a 1 and a 6 on a single die roll, then the chance of either one happening is just the sum of their individual probabilities.
Got it. PA or B plus PB, but only if A and B can both happen.
Precisely.
And in the simplest cases, like a fair coin or a fair die, we often deal with a discrete uniform distribution where everything's equally likely.
Yep. The classic scenario. Probability is just counting them. Number of ways your event can happen divided by the total number of possible outcomes. Easy peasy.
But you mentioned this simple coin toss model. Mm-hmm. It's the launch pad for much more complex stuff.
Oh, definitely. That's kind of our theme today. How does just repeating that simple coin toss, how does that lead us to things like the binomial distribution and even connect to ideas from physics and information theory like entropy? It gets deep fast.
Okay, let's go there. Repetition. We toss the coin not once, but many, many times. And let's say the coin isn't necessarily fair. It has a heads bias. Let's call it P$1.
Right. P$1 is the true underlying probability of getting a head on any single toss. Might be 0.5 for a fair coin, might be 0.6, whatever.
So if we toss it, say, 1,000 times, 1,000,000 times, what happens to the results? How do they stack up?
Now we get to the two absolute giants of probability theory. Results derive directly from this idea of repeated trials. First up is the law of large numbers, the LLN. This one's more qualitative. It basically assures us that as you do more and more tosses, so as an R gets really big, the proportion of heads you actually observe gets closer and closer to that true bias, pay.
So the average you see eventually matches the underlying truth, given enough data.
That's the guarantee. The long run reveals the bias.
Okay, that gives us confidence in the long run, but what about the shape of the results along the way? How does the variation look? That feels more practical.
Exactly, and that's the second giant, the central limit theorem, the CLT. This one is quantitative. It's incredibly powerful. It tells us that for a large number of trials, the distribution of the results, like if you made a histogram of the number of heads you got in many sets of dollar tosses, that histogram will look like a normal distribution.
The bell curve.
The bell curve. It emerges almost like magic from repeating simple, independent events.
And the source material really stresses this isn't just a coin flipping thing, right? The iris data set example.
Oh, yeah, that's a great illustration. You take complex measurements from nature, like petal lengths in flowers. They might have some weird distribution on their own. But if you take lots of small samples, calculate the average length within each sample. Those averages themselves, when you plot them, they form a near-perfect normal distribution.
Wow. So the CLT is like this fundamental organizing principle for averages, no matter what the original data looks like.
Pretty much. It's why the normal distribution is so ubiquitous in statistics and science. Aggregation smooths things out into that bell shape.
And you mentioned this connects to entropy. How does that work?
Well, think about getting a certain proportion dollars of heads in other tosses. Let's say exactly 50 heads in 100 tosses. There are many different sequences of heads and tails that result in exactly 50 heads. The number of ways, let's call it E tag N, turns out to be related to entropy. For large dollars, it's approximately Yi NHP ed, where entropy is that binary entropy function.
So HP days is sort of measuring the number of ways the system can arrange itself to give that macroscopic result.
But in a sense, yes. It connects the probability of an outcome to the sheer number of microscopic arrangements or configurations that produce it. Outcomes near the average are more likely simply because there are vastly more ways for them to happen.
Okay, fascinating. Now let's shift gears slightly. We've talked about predicting outcomes if we know the bias T dollars.
Right, forward probability.
But often we need the reverse.
Yeah.
Right? Inference. We see the results like a series of coin tosses and we want to figure out what the bias P dollar is.
Exactly. This is where conditional probability comes in. Asking, what's the probability of event A, given that we know event B has already happened? We write it as text probit AB.
The probability of A conditional on B.
And the engine for calculating this, for turning the question around, is the famous Bayes' theorem. Bayes' theorem gives us the formula. Text prob equals text prob Bay A, all divided by text prob equals all divided by text prob. It lets us use what we know about Bay Fulber happening, if Astra LA is true, to find the probability of Astra being true now that we've seen Bay dollars. It's how we update our beliefs.
This sounds like where things can get tricky. The example about smoking and cancer really highlights this, doesn't it?
It's a classic. Let's lay it out. Say 20% of people smoke. That's text prob 0.22.
Okay.
And let's say the probability of having cancer, given you're a smoker, is high, like 90%. So text cancer 0.99.
Right.
But importantly, some non-smokers also get cancer. Let's say the probability of not having cancer if you're a non-smoker is 80%. Text no cancer, text non-smoker, which means text cancer is 0.2 or 20%.
Okay, got the numbers. So the crucial question is, if someone presents with cancer, what's the probability they are a smoker? Text cancer.
Exactly. We need to flip the condition using Bayes. We need text cancer, text smoker, and the overall text cancer. That overall probability of cancer, text cancer, has to account for both pathways, smokers getting cancer and non-smokers getting cancer. It's text cancer, plus text cancer, text non-smoker. Okay, let's plug those in. 0.9 times 0.2 plus 0.2 times 0.8, which gives you 0.18 plus 0.16 equals 0.34. That's the overall probability of someone having cancer in this population.
Okay, 34%. Now for Bayes, text cancer times text smoker. So that's 0.9 times 0.2 and 0.343.
This is 0.180.34. That comes out to about 0.529, roughly 53%.
53%.
Wait, only 53%? That seems low. Given that 90% of smokers get cancer in this scenario, why isn't it higher? It's the power of the base rate. Even though a non-smoker's individual risk is much lower, 20% than it's 90%, there are just so many more non-smokers, 80% of the population versus 20%. So that smaller risk applied to a much larger group generates a significant number of cancer cases, diluting the pool. Bayes forces you to weigh the evidence against the background prevalence.
That's really important. Ignoring the base rate totally messes up your intuition about the risk.
Absolutely critical lesson. And, you know, there's also Bayes' theorem the third, which connects this logic to functions like the logistic function, often symbolized as sigma.
Ah, the sigmoid curve.
Right. It's a neat function that takes any real number input, maybe some activation energy from a model, and squashes it perfectly into a probability $2 between 0 and 1. It's a bridge from raw scores to probabilities.
Okay, so Bayes helps us infer. But to even use these tools, we need to quantify the outcomes of our experiments, right? Turn results like heads or roll to six into numbers.
Precisely. That's the job of random variables, or RVs. An RV, usually written as $6, is simply a function that maps outcomes from the sample space Zillow dollars to numerical values. The specific value it takes on for a given outcome is a sample, $6.
So for a coin toss, $6 could be 1 for heads, 0 for tails. For a die roll, $6 could just be the number showing, 1 through 6.
Exactly. Once we have these numerical representations, we can talk about their properties using moments. The most important moment is the mean or expected value. It's the theoretical long-run average value of the RV, what you'd expect to get on average over many repetitions.
And the other key one.
Variance, text var. This measures the spread or variability of the possible values around that mean. A high variance means the outcomes are widely scattered. Low variance means they cluster tightly. Standard deviation is just the square root of variance, putting it back in the original units.
Got it. And the simplest RVs build on each other, like the coin toss again.
Yep. A single toss, outcome zero worn with probability for dollars is a Bernoulli random variable. Its mean is just B dollars. Its variance is POR. Now, if you sum up dollar-independent Bernoulli trials, like counting the total heads and dollar tosses, you get a binomial random variable. And its moments scale beautifully. The mean is simply NP Rallor. The variance is NP1PL.
That scaling seems important. Does the mean always add up like that?
Yes. That's the linearity of expectation. It's incredibly useful. The expected value of a sum of RVs, or a weighted sum, is always the sum of their individual expected values.
Right.
Text E, AX plus by Y plus B text EY. No conditions needed.
Always. That's powerful.
It is. But variance. Variance is trickier. The variance of a sum, text Y, only equals the sum of the variances. Text Y if $6 are independent.
There's the catch. Independence again.
If they're not independent, if they influence each other, you have this extra covariance term you need to account for, making things more complicated. Independence simplifies variance calculations dramatically.
And this links back to why sampling works, right? Taking the average of a sample.
Exactly. Consider the sample mean, two sample mean, which is just the average of independent observations of some RV tuple. Thanks to linearity expectation, the expected value of the sample mean is just the true population mean. Your sample average is, on average, correct.
Unbiased, they call it.
Right. And because the observations are independent, the variance adds up simply. The variance of the sum is 1 sigma, if sigma 2 is the variance of one observation. But since the sample mean involves dividing by null, its variance becomes texma 2 n2 n2 prother.
So the variance shrinks as you get more data, by a factor of norm.
Precisely. The sample mean becomes a more and more reliable estimate of the true mean as your sample size null grows. Its distribution gets tighter and tighter around nomol.
Which leads us back to the normal distribution, doesn't it? The CLT tells us the shape of that tightening distribution is the bell curve.
Exactly. And we usually work with the standard normal distribution, often called zeta. It's the pure bell curve shape, centered perfectly at mean zero, with a variance and standard deviation of exactly one. Its probability density function is that famous P(1) squirt known. All other normal distributions are just shifted and scaled versions of the standard one.
And we use this standard shape to judge how unusual an observation is, using standard deviations as the yardstick, the 68-95-99 rule.
That's the one. Roughly 68% of the data falls within one standard deviation, $1 sigma, of the mean, about 95.5% within $2 sigma, and almost everything, 99.7%, within $3 sigma.
So if something is, say, 2.5 standard deviations away from the mean, it's pretty unlikely to happen just by chance.
Very unlikely. This forms the basis of statistical significance. We quantify that unlikeliness with a p-value. The p-value is the probability of observing a result as extreme as, or more extreme than, what you actually saw, assuming that only chance is operating, often called the null hypothesis.
And the thresholds are conventional, right?
Yes. Typically, if the p-value is less than or equal to 0.05, 5%, we call the result significant. We reject the idea it was just chance. If it's less than or equal to 0.01, 1%, we call it highly significant, even stronger evidence against chance.
And that standard deviation of the sample mean, sigma squared, gets its own special name because it's so important for this.
The standard error. It's the scale factor, the sigma. For the distribution of the sample mean, it tells you how much variability you expect in sample means due to random sampling.
Let's use that great example again. Class mean, $80, standard deviation sigma, 34.
Okay.
One student gets 84. That's 4 points above the mean. Since sigma four-door, that's a Z score of 84, 84 equals 1.
Right. Z calls 1, 1 then.
Right. The p-value for Z011 is about 16%. Not significant. Happens all the time.
But now, say N33 students have an average grade of 84, the deviation is still 4 points. But now we use the standard error.
Standard error is sigma squared in four scores, which is about 2.31.
So the new Z-score for the sample mean is sieving for $3.84, which is about 1.73. And the p-value for Z1.733 is about 0.0416, or 4.16%.
Uh-huh. Now it's below 5%. Just by averaging three students, that same four-point deviation becomes statistically significant.
Keep going. What if 166 students average 84?
Standard error is $4. The Z-score is 84.80s. Four, about $2.45.
The p-value for Z2.455 is tiny, around 0.0007 or 0.7%.
Highly significant. Wow. So the exact same difference from the mean, 84 versus 80, gets progressively weirder or less likely by chance as the sample size grows. That really shows the LLN and CLT loyalty working together via the standard error.
It's a perfect illustration. More data gives you more power to detect real effects. And just briefly, another important distribution built from the normal is the chi-squared distribution, often written chi-dollar. If you take independent standard normal variables, zeta dollar, z dot, cd do, square them, and add them up, the result follows a chi-squared distribution with dollar degrees of freedom. $1 is z12 plus dots plus zd2.
And what's that used for?
It's fundamental for things like testing goodness of fit or testing for independence between categorical variables and contingency tables. Asking questions like, is the observed pattern of responses significantly different from what we'd expect if these factors were unrelated? Its mean is dollars and its variance is $2.
Okay, so we've gone from coins, Bernoulli binomial, to averages, normal via CLT, and now sums of squares, G squared. What about generalizing beyond just two outcomes, like heads tails, like rolling a die?
Right. That takes us to multinomial probability. Instead of just P1 pia, you have a vector of probability, say P1, P2, dots, PK, for K possible outcomes, where all the P sum to 010.
And how do we represent the outcome? If we roll a 4 on a 6-sided die?
We often use one-hot encoding. It's a simple vector representation. For a 6-sided die, the outcome 4 would be represented by the vector $2, 0s, 0s, 0, 1, 1 mid in the fourth position, 0s everywhere else.
Got it. A clean way to make categories numerical.
And just like the logistic function mapped a single number to a binary probability, we need a function to map a vector of scores or inputs into a valid probability vector that sums to 1. That's the softmax function.
Softmax. I hear that a lot in machine learning.
Exactly. It takes a vector of arbitrary real numbers, say math BFY, Y1 dots YK, and outputs a vector math BFQ, where each sum J1K OK, each dollar is between 0 and 1, and they all sum to 1. It's the multinomial generalization of the logistic sigmoid.
Okay, that brings us near the end, and to a crucial point the source has flagged about terminology getting mixed up.
Yes, this is a really important practical heads up for anyone working in this field, especially with information theory concepts or ML libraries. It's about information versus entropy. Specifically, the quantity known mathematically as relative information, often written APQ or DAKLPQ, the Kolbach-Leibler divergence, measures the inefficiency of assuming the distribution is dollar when the true distribution is dollar.
Okay, a measure of distance or difference between distributions.
Right. But the source material explicitly warns that this quantity, relative information, is very often incorrectly called relative entropy in textbooks, in research papers, and even baked into the naming conventions of major software libraries.
Why does getting the name wrong matter so much? Isn't it just semantics?
Not when it comes to optimization. Mathematical properties are different. Relative information is a convex function. Entropy is a concave function.
Ah. And in machine learning, we're always minimizing or maximizing things.
Exactly. We typically want to minimize loss functions or measures of error or distance, like relative information. Those need to be convex for our optimization algorithms to work reliably. We typically want to maximize things like uncertainty or diversity, which are related to entropy, and those functions should be concave.
So if a library calls a function relative entropy, but it's actually the convex relative information, and you try to maximize it thinking it's entropy, you're going completely the wrong way.
You could be fighting your own algorithm, yes. Knowing the correct mathematical property, convexity or concavity, associated with information versus entropy is crucial for applying them correctly.
That is a key takeaway. Names matter because the underlying math matters. So, wrapping this up, we've journeyed from a single coin toss, saw how repetition leads to the law of large numbers giving long-term certainty, and the central limit theorem giving us the normal distribution to quantify the variation around that certainty.
Right. And we saw how tools like Bayes' theorem allow us to perform inference, updating our beliefs based on evidence, being careful about those Bayes rates, and things like random variables, expected value, variance, standard error, and the normal and chi-squared distributions. These are the fundamental tools we use to measure outcomes, assess variability, and determine if what we observe is statistically significant or just noise.
The LNN promises predictability in the long run, but the CLT and these tools tell us how much data we need and how much deviation is truly meaningful.
Precisely. They quantify the reliability of our knowledge gained from random processes.
And for a final thought, we touched on that connection between information IP and another function, the cumulant generating function, ZOY, through a concept called convex duality.
Max CT, ET do, den. Dan Y. See
it? Yes, the Legendre-Finchel transform.
It suggests this deep, almost symmetrical relationship between measuring information or order
and the mechanism that generates probabilities. They define each other.
Two sides of the same coin, mathematically.
So if information and probability generation are so tightly linked, what does that imply about the ultimate limits? Are there fundamental mathematical constraints on the maximum amount of certainty or information we can ever hope to extract from any system, no matter how much data we gather? Something to think about.